The book of Ecclesiastes is one of the wisdom books of the Old Testament. It's a book that brings to us the wisdom of God and does so in a twofold way, essentially, I think. It seeks to make us wise about the life of faith lived out in a fallen world. It seeks to impress upon us that wisdom will look at this world for what it is, a fallen world, a sinful world, a world that God, Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8, a world that God has consigned to futility or frustration. It's a sin-cursed world. And therefore we must realize that the life of faith is lived out in the reality of this life under the sun, in this sin-cursed world. We are not yet home. We are not yet in a sphere where sin has been banished and where life is all sweetness and harmony and wholeness and blessedness. We live out the life of faith in a world consigned by God to frustration because of Adam's sin. And therefore we should not be surprised when limitedness and frustration and disappointments and bewilderments and perplexities cross our paths. God does not exempt his church from living in a sin-cursed world. We do not live in a spiritual bubble that cocoons us from the realities of living in a world that brings us tears and frustrations and limitedness. This is the authentic life of faith. But alongside that, Solomon also wants, probably from his own experience, to impress upon God's church that even though we live under the sun, the ache in our hearts, which belongs to the very fabric of our existence as men and women, boys and girls made in the image of God, that very ache can only be satisfied beyond the sun. Not that we live heedless of this present world, but that we realize that only the one who dwells beyond the sun can invade life under the sun and give us during the years allotted to us a measure of the significance and longing and joy that we are capable of receiving and experiencing. There is a note of unrelenting frustration pulsing through every Christian believer. And the reason for that is simple. We are far from home, living in bodies where sin yet troubles us, in a world that God has cursed because of Adam's sin and our sin in Adam. Ecclesiastes is a commentary on life by a man of faith to people of faith. It does not fit into neat categories, just like life itself. Life is not neat. Ecclesiastes, at least in my own reading of it, is in turn insightful, perplexing, deeply humbling, frustrating, exhilarating. It's all of those things because life is all of those things. And if there was one phrase that it seems to me at least captures the essence of the book of Ecclesiastes, it would be Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 5. We live by faith and not by sight. And the context of those words in 2 Corinthians 5, 6 are very significant. Paul is speaking about the temporariness of our present condition. We are men and women who are bound for an eternal home not made by human hands. Like Abraham and others, we are looking forward to a city which is to come, whose builder and maker is God. And so we live by faith and not by sight. And that's why, like many good books, you only really get the point of Ecclesiastes, although it is at times brightly hinted at throughout the book, you only really get the point when you begin to draw towards the conclusion. When, for example, in chapter 11, Solomon says, "Follow the ways of your heart, and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you to judgment." There is an eternal dimension to life. God will bring you to judgment. Let that note shape what you desire and what your heart seeks after. And beginning of chapter 12, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come." Now, why is that? So that when the days of trouble come, you have remembered your Creator. That is to say, you have placed your hope and your trust and your confidence in the God who has saved His people throughout history and guarded them and kept them and blessed them. And again in verse 6 of chapter 12, "Remember Him before the cord is severed and the Spirit returns to God who gave it." As long as we live under the sun, we who confess Jesus Christ, believers in the living God, we need constantly to be reminded that nothing under the sun can begin to satisfy the ache in our hearts for life. God has set eternity in our hearts, as we read in chapter 3, verse 11. There is an eternal dimension to it, and nothing under the sun. And it may well be that Solomon, from the vantage point of old age, as he looks back over the wreckage of his own life, as a man who indulged himself in everything, is saying, let me tell you, nothing under the sun can begin to satisfy the eternity that God has set within our hearts. And the reason for that is this: it cannot satisfy us because we were made in the image of the One who dwells, as it were, beyond the sun. Now let me say again, for this is basic, I think, to the substructure of Ecclesiastes. We live in a cursed world, subjected by God to frustration, to futility. The same word that's used here, vanity of vanities. It's the Greek translation of it in Romans 8:20. God has subjected this world to futility. Therefore, life will inevitably be punctuated by frustration, limitedness, and failure. Now that can become an excuse. You say, well, that's what life's about. You just take the rough with the smooth. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a realism to faith that does not look to get more out of this life than God has decreed for it. We live by faith and not by sight, for if we live by sight, life would disintegrate around us. Do you not think so? If you were to live by sight, what would you conclude about God? What would you conclude about yourself? If we to go by the eyes in our heads, what conclusions would we draw? We live by faith and not by sight. Now, this would surely resonate with a people who worship an invisible God, as the Hebrews did, and who, like Abraham, were looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder was God, who were looking forward, as it were, in New Covenant language, to a new heavens and a new earth, the home of righteousness. And that's why, in this section, which we're going to look at now, really very briefly, the key phrase, if I can pick one out, are those opening words in verse 25 of chapter 2, "For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy." Without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? And what Solomon does from verse 12 of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 2 is to take us on a tour of exploration, the grand tour, as it used to be called. And he invites us to share the discoveries he made when he gave himself to exploring life under the sun. And indeed, as he tells us in verse 10 and in verse 12 of chapter 2, he explored every conceivable avenue of life under the sun. Verse 10 of chapter 2, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. He had the world at his feet. He could do anything he wanted. There was nothing limited about it. And yet he says in verse 12, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. Solomon's search echoes, does it not, the search in every human heart. I've often been profoundly struck by these words of Herman Bavinck. If you don't have this little book, A Reasonable Faith, a Dutchman who could write theology. Well, many of them could write theology, but that's who could write theology. Herman Bavinck. Listen to what Bavinck says in the opening chapter, Man's Highest Good. I'm always told that it's fatal in preaching to read lengthily, but I'm going to try it and hope still to keep you with me. This is what he writes. All men are really seeking after God, as Augustine declared, but they do not all seek him in the right way, nor in the right place. They seek him down below, and he is above. They seek him on the earth, and he is in heaven. They seek him afar, and he is nearby. They seek him in money, in property, in fame, in power, and in passion. And he is to be found in the high and holy places, and with him that is of a contrite and humble spirit. They seek him, and at the same time, they flee him. They feel themselves attracted to God, and at the same time, repelled by him. In this, as Pascal so profoundly pointed out, consists the greatness and the miserableness of man. He longs for truth and is false by nature. He yearns for rest and throws himself from one diversion upon another. He pants for a permanent and eternal bliss and seizes on the pleasures of a moment. He seeks for God and loses himself in the creature. So look with me after that somewhat lengthy introduction. Look with me just very briefly at two things. First of all, in chapter 1, verses 12 through 15, Solomon prepares us for the worst. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study, to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And here's the reason why. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Under the sun, says Solomon, there is a twistedness that no one can put straight, no matter how hard they try. Now, the reason for that is later told us in chapter 7, verse 13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what He has made crooked? God has made this world the way it is. It didn't simply evolve in that way. It is God's moral judgment on the world. It is God's declared judgment that the world be as it is, the result of sin and fallenness. It's not simply that sin evolved the world to be like that. There's a measure of truth in that. But more profoundly, God made the world twisted. God made the world the way it is, full of perplexity and bewilderment. God makes things crooked. God gives this world its pains and its travails. Yes, God does do hurricanes and earthquakes. Now, many people shut their ears at that and say, well, what kind of cosmic fiend is this? God does earthquakes and hurricanes? Indeed He does. Indeed He does. Does evil fall upon a city and the Lord has not done it? Says Amos. But thankfully, some don't run away. They stop to ask, why? Why did God do this? Why does He do this? But what Solomon is highlighting here is the innate helplessness in us all. We cannot change this world. We cannot change ourselves. That's the folly of so many of the isms in this world. Environmentalism or socialism or even capitalism. They think they can straighten what God's made crooked. And they can't. They can't. And is this perhaps the heavy burden that God has laid on men? Is this what Solomon is saying? I've come to see that we cannot straighten what God has made crooked. This is the futility of wisdom under the sun. It doesn't understand who man is or what this world is. That we are made in God's image, that this is God's world. And that God has made us the way it is. Bavinck has a wonderful little phrase where he says, man is an enigma whose solution can only be found in God. You see, this inability to solve life's puzzle and to cure human crookedness is why so many brilliant minds die in despair. Because they see that essentially they've done nothing. And that's why the simplest believer has more wisdom than the world's greatest unbelieving intellects. Because the simplest believer knows that there is more to life than meets the eye. That even when engulfed in God's at times bewildering ways, the believer has a faith that can penetrate the veil, even dimly and uncertainly at times, but truly. So Solomon actually here, as he begins his exposition of life under the sun, prepares us for the worst. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Reckon with that. until Jesus Christ comes again, who is the wisdom of God, the ultimate wisdom. He will then put right by creating a new heavens and a new earth. He will straighten what God in his sovereign, righteous, moral judgment made crooked. He will bring a new heavens and a new earth, the home of righteousness, where nothing will be crooked. Everything will be sweet harmony. Now what Solomon does from verse 16 to the end of chapter 2 is to take us with him on this journey of exploration. And let me just look with you as we read through these verses what Solomon discovered. His first stop was wisdom, verse 16 following. It's striking, is it not, that there is no mention here of wisdom's first principle. What is the first principle of wisdom? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There's no mention of that. And what does he tell us then here? Where does wisdom, where does man's brilliant insight lead to? It leads you nowhere. I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. We live in the most educated age the world has ever known. And we hold out wisdom. We might almost translate it here, education, as the hope of the world. We live in the most educated age the world has ever known, but also the most tragic. Let me give you one example. We educate the young about sex to cure society of unwanted pregnancies. But how do we actually get rid of unwanted pregnancies? We put to death God's own image in the womb of women. We kill unwanted children. That's what we do. That's the age in which we live. Solomon says, wisdom, I had more of it than anyone who ruled over Jerusalem before me. And it gets you nowhere. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. And then, in beginning verses of chapter 2, really throughout up to verse 10, he tries hedonism or self-indulgent folly and frivolity. He tries wine, women, and song, do you notice, in these verses. What's interesting there, I think, is this. He was so close, but so far. Wine, women, and song. God gives us wine to cheer the heart. He gives us song to rejoice the soul. He gives us one woman to fulfill our lives. So near and yet so far. People grasping at the good gifts of God, but when divorced from God, they become avenues to disaster. The more he indulged himself, the more, verse 11, nothing was gained. Nothing was gained. And then mixed in with all of this, he tries creativity. Verse 4 following. I undertook great projects. I built houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. Planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. And the language cannot but remind you of Genesis chapter 2, of Adam in the garden. Here is a secular Garden of Eden, as it were. But there are two key phrases in that section that we need to take to heart. Verse 4, I undertook great projects and built houses for myself. Verse 8, I amassed silver and gold for myself. himself. God was not in all his thoughts. And he is sharing with us his own discovery. That when self becomes the centerpiece of existence, when self becomes the raison d'etre for all we are and all we do, the end product is this: everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And that point is further highlighted in verses 12 through 16. And this is exactly what so many unbelievers say to Christian believers today. Look what Solomon says in verse 13. I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize the same fate overtakes them both. They both die. And folks say that to Christian believers. You Christian believers, you're living in a fool's paradise. You all stop breathing at the same time as unbelievers. You all rot in the dust of this earth. Dust you are, dust you will return to. And the believer says, I live by faith and not by sight. You live on the basis of what you can see. I live on the basis of the God who is and who has spoken. There's more to life than meets the eye, you know. There's more to life than meets the eye. But as Solomon takes us on this tour, he says in verse 16, the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. When the end of existence is self, life becomes a treadmill of meaninglessness. I've never been happy with the idea that salvation is about providing satisfaction. There's a sense in which that's true. But it turns things really on their head. For what is our satisfaction? What is the great satisfaction of the Christian believer? It is the exaltation of Jesus Christ. When he is glorified, my heart is satisfied. His glory is our satisfaction. Nothing more sweetens our souls, enriches our lives, expands our affections, delights our souls than the exaltation of Jesus Christ. But Solomon comes in verse 17 to this point, so he says, I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. I don't have time to unpack all of this, but he had given himself to pleasure, but now he's giving way to despair. To use the familiar illustration, he's like a man who sees only the underside of the tapestry on the loom. That's all he can see. Tangled skeins of thread, knots, and he says, I hated life. But there's another side to the tapestry, and we are called to live by faith and not by sight. And that's what verses 24 to 26 highlight. There's another side to the story. Solomon is writing as a believer. He's not writing as a congenital pessimist. He says, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him who can eat or find enjoyment, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth. To what end? To to hand it over to the one who pleases God. Who is the one who pleases God? You could answer that in many ways, but foundationally in this way. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. What pleases God is that we believe God, that we trust God. And what Solomon is saying is that he discovered that without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Life is lived under the sun. But our life under the sun is anchored to the one who dwells, as it were, beyond the sun. And in fellowship with him, something of life beyond the sun breaks into the confusion and twistedness of life under the sun. Yes, the wise man and the fool both die apparently in the same way. But the unobservable difference is this. The wise man dies with God. There's more to life than meets the eye. That's why in the midst of a fallen, sin-cursed world where everything appears at times meaningless, where disasters blight multitudes and famines kill multitudes and the strong trample on the weak, the poor and the unborn, the Christian believer can yet experience joy in the midst of imbecilic chaos. Joy that is a foretaste of that unimaginable joy that yet awaits us beyond the sun. There will be an ultimate reversal. The sinner, God gives to the sinner the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. According to our lights, who can tell whether a wise man or a fool will inherit? But according to faith, the answer is plain. All things are yours, says Paul to the Corinthians. All things are yours because you are Christ's and Christ is God's. So what is Ecclesiastes? It's a sustained appeal to us to live by faith and not by sight. We need true wisdom, the wisdom that trusts God, that knows that without him, who could eat or find pleasure or enjoyment in anything? But that when we please him, when we live by faith and not by sight, he gives us wisdom, knowledge, and joy. Think of it like this, just as I close. Solomon left his kingdom to a fool. He says in verse 18, I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he be a wise man or a fool? Rehoboam was a fool. Under the sun, there are times when nothing makes sense. Maybe you think that's overstating the point. Maybe. But we live in a world that God has made crooked. And so we wait for a better king than Solomon. We look for a greater than Solomon. We look beyond the sun to a new heavens and a new earth, the home of righteousness, the end of all vanity and frustration, because sin will be no more. And that's why at the end Solomon says, remember your Creator. Boys and girls who are here tonight, the Word of God says, remember your Creator when you're young. Remember him. That is to say, love him, serve him, cherish him, honor him, delight in him, so that when you get older, and you begin to discover that life can be hard, and things happen that we've got no answers for, and desires are not fulfilled, and you almost want to say, Lord, where are you? Where are you? You've so remembered your Creator that you stand with the Church of God in all the ages and you say, I will live by faith and not by sight. I will trust the Lord who spared not his only Son for me. Life under the sun is punctuated by life beyond the sun. God gives us joy, but as one commentator puts it, joy at the end of a tether. It's limited joy, because the best is yet to be. Here we have no continuing city, but we look forward to a city that is to come, whose builder and maker is God. May God help us in the interim to live by faith and not by sight.